This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast, your chance to catch up on your best bits, listen again, and connect with some amazing experts from the region and beyond. Ludmilla Malova, our resident legal eagle, was with us for our regular legal clinic, your chance to get an expert opinion on anything to do with your, where you stand with your rights here in the UAE. From car crashes to retail, from property to gratuity, she was on hand. And it was paternity leave that was under the microscope. How many days did you or your partner get here in the UAE? Was it a matter of none, or is your company going above and beyond? We were talking about the legal requirements and speaking to a house husband too, Grant Lupton, sharing his experiences and some of the misconceptions as well. And it was many matters with Zurich Insurance, answering your questions about life insurance, critical illness cover, and crucially why it's so important to have this in place. Even if you're young and healthy, perhaps this is the ideal time to take some action and tick off that thing on your to-do list.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Fantastic to have you with us this afternoon, and we are very much here for you. It's your free legal clinic. So whether you've got something that you just can't quite get to the bottom of through Googling, through news channels or HR department, your landlord, whatever it might be, please do be the one to start the conversation. Get the answers that you need. That can be on text, on the app, or on the phone line as well. We have got our resident legal eagle, Ludmilla Malova, joining us from HPL, Malova and Pluka, live on Microsoft Teams. Is there a hairdryer in your, or a fan in your office, Ludmilla? You look like you're in a Beyonce video over there.
Wow, you are very observant. I do have a fan here.
It's glorious.
I have two sets of AC and a fan. And when I look glamorous, I turn on the fan so that my hair can blow and I look like a Beyonce. So, voila, you caught me.
I love it. Brains and beauty. Well, it's great to have you with us. Get ready for a busy one, as you always are. It is, of course, UA Father's Day today. So I just wanted to really get your take from a legal standpoint, Ludmilla, if you don't mind. We had a message from Brian saying, what does the law say on paternity leave? HR says, unfortunately, I don't get any since I mostly work from home. Wife is giving birth in 3 weeks. Can you please clarify?
Sure. The law, actually, the UAE labor law has been amended recently, and specifically it now includes provision to allow expecting fathers or new fathers to take paternity leave of up to 5 working days, and can be either up to 6 months or, I guess, within the 6 months of the baby's arrival. So, and these 5 days can be taken either as a whole, together, all 5 days together, or in bits. And it can be either before the baby's arrival or after, as long as it is within the first 6 months from baby's birth. So it is not expressly provided for in the law, and that's not really negotiable. And there is no provision in the law that somehow denies that benefit to those who work from home. So it sounds like in the case of the listener, the HR may want to update themselves on the labor laws.
I'm sure we can find a link that you can send to in a pointed fashion, Brian. And what about exceptions? On our DMs earlier, we had questions about adoption and if that is recognised when it comes to paternity and even maternity leave here in the UAE.
Sure. So adoption in the UAE, just to clarify, to adopt legally, adoption has to take place outside of the UAE. At present, adoption in the UAE is not possible. So whenever we're hearing about adoption cases that are happening within the UAE, these are adoption cases where all the paperwork has been completed before arrival into the UAE. So therefore, once the family arrives here, that baby is already their baby. It's legally their baby. With regards to the law does not differentiate or discriminate between biological children or adopted children. So in that particular case, the same benefits would apply to expecting fathers or expecting mothers, whether it's a biological child or adopted child. So there are no exceptions. The law treats the same way both types of children.
I think that's Fantastic. And, you know, the UAE is the first Arab country to grant parental leave to employees in the private sector. We're seeing changes and improvements all the time. What I would say to anyone, and we'll be talking about this in detail in an hour's time, is just because it's 5 working days doesn't mean that as a company you can't do better than that. You might, you could offer more. I'm sure it would be appreciated. And what about education allowance? We have had a message from Nitin saying HR last year announced will no longer receive education allowance every year. Haven't received anything in writing. I've got 2 children, need to pay their tuition fees in a couple of months for September term. Thank you. We're seeing a lot of this, unfortunately, over the course of the last 18 months. Salaries being reduced, benefits being cut as well. What process does a company need to undertake in order for that to be legal? Is it a case of changing contracts? In Nitin's case, he's saying he hasn't received anything in writing. Where do people stand when these adjustments are made?
Sure. So with regards to the education allowance, there are two ways to look at it. One is that there is no express provision in the law that that obligates employers or companies to provide education allowance to their employees. Therefore, it is a benefit that is contractually agreed on and provided for by contract or by agreement. So if it is not in the agreement, there's nothing in the law that requires companies to provide that benefit, unlike, for example, salary and holidays and other types of benefits like insurance. So that's one. So with regards to if that particular benefit either provided for in the contract or provided for in practice, then it becomes a matter of contract. And a contract can be either in writing or evidenced by practice. So let's say in the case of this particular listener, there was education allowance either in the contract or maybe it was never mentioned in the contract, but he has been receiving education allowance for the last however many years. So in either of those scenarios, that particular benefit is now part of the employment agreement between him and the company, and therefore it is a benefit to which he is now entitled to because for obvious reasons he has reasonable grounds to expect it. Mm-hmm. When that particular benefit or any other benefit in the employment context is being taken away, it constitutes what's called as an amendment to a contract or amendment to the employment agreement. Now, agreement, in particular employment agreements, requires consent of both parties in order to be amended. In this particular case, the company cannot just make a decision unilaterally and say we will no longer pay you a schooling allowance. It requires the consent of the employee. That being said, if they don't provide anything in writing and they just stop paying education allowance and the employee does not challenge the company's decision in that regard. And by challenge, I don't mean just, for example, send an email, say, I protest, but, for example, file a court case. And if an X number of months go by and he continues to keep working for the company without the education allowance, it can be deemed as an implicit acceptance of the amended terms of the contract. In other words, that he has implicitly accepted this variable or variation to his contract. Okay. In other words, you don't have, as a company, it's not necessarily the case that they have to memorialize it in writing. If they do it in by practice and the employee accepts it, then that becomes sort of the new contract.
Okay. All right.
In the case of the listener, if he does not, if it is important to him and if it is a big benefit, he certainly should put something in writing and challenge the company's practice in this regard, because it's illegal for the company to unilaterally amend the contract, but he just needs to be prepared that the company does not change its position in this regard, because as you rightfully said, these have been fairly difficult times for all companies and businesses. It may be financial, they can no longer afford this. So then the listener just has to be prepared in the event the company cannot offer that benefit anymore, what his next steps will be apart from resigning.
In terms of relationships and resigning, it is a huge benefit. I mean, my goodness, education allowance is an incredible thing to have. So Nitin, sorry that you're having some issues there.
Work-Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line, delighted to have our resident legal expert. And just for lifting the curtain behind the scenes, Ludmila Malova is not briefed on our topics or, of course, any of your messages, which are coming in real time. She is that clever. So delighted to have Ludmila with us. A message here, Ludmila, and again, no name on this one, understandably, saying, is an employer obligated to provide medical insurance until the resident's visa expires or is cancelled?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. One is that it only the requirement for the employer to provide insurance or health insurance only applies to two emirates at present, and that's Dubai and Abu Dhabi. In other emirates, there is no requirement per se. It could be done as part of the company's policy, but not by law. So therefore, if we're talking about Abu Dhabi and Dubai, then yes, there's that requirement. Now, that requirement is linked to the employment context. So you have your the company is required to provide you with health insurance as long as you're employed. So it is attached to the employment relationship. Now, in technical terms and theoretically, your employment should be linked to your visa. So therefore, as long as you are employed by the company, your visa is active, then your health insurance has to last for that period of time. Now, in practical terms, however, there's often discrepancies between the time you you finish your employment and the time you actually cancel your visa. And I'd say out of abundance of caution, the health insurance definitely should at least, last until the visa is canceled, because until such time, technically speaking, the company is still responsible responsible for the employer or for the employee. So, in other words, the sponsorship relationship where the company is acting as a sponsor and therefore responsible for the employee. And therefore, in practical terms, it's in the interest of the company to continue to pay for the insurance. So, in that something does happen to the employee, that the company has proper policies to assist in that regard. Okay. But really, logically speaking, it's tied more to employment versus residence visa. But in practical terms, I'd recommend that it's at least until the visa is cancelled.
Absolutely. Now, we are seeing a lot of people in this situation right now, and we hope some companies are able to extend some generosity until the end of that. Shireen's been in touch with me there saying, my question is, with a freelance visa in Abu Dhabi, can I invoice companies for services provided with an invoice that does not have a trade license number? Does that make sense to you? Because I'm not clear.
I think maybe the listener is asking whether under her freelance mm-hmm. license, she can invoice a different entity mm-hmm. That does not have a license. Technically speaking, yes. I mean, it's really more the because you can provide services to somebody other than a corporate entity. So, for example, if I wanted an individual came and wanted to retain my services, my legal services, that individual is retaining me in his or her individual capacity and not on behalf of a company. So, therefore, in that regard, they will not have a trade license and they can still hire my services. Similarly, so if I understand the listener's question, it would be a very similar circumstance. And that is she has freelancing companies, so she's providing services to an individual who does not have a trade license. So that in of itself is legal. But what she's referring to is something related more to her license, and that is she doesn't have a trade license. Well, then, technically speaking, to provide any kind of commercial services or business, you do need to have a proper trade license. But since there is a mention, at least of a freelance visa, I assume there is a freelance license that's attached to that freelance mm-hmm. visa.
Okay. Really hope that helps. Thank you for this message from Sunny saying, in Dubai, you get 30 days additional cover from the time your visa is cancelled. In Abu Dhabi, the insurance is cancelled from the date when cancellation is raised by the employer. The company in both the Emirates can cancel a little later, depending on the condition or request of the employee. Thank you for that.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I honestly do hope you haven't got any legal issues, but if you do, you are in the right place. And that can be anything from employment and gratuity through to property. Maybe you're a tenant or a landlord who needs some help with the other party. Or perhaps it comes down to some maybe shoddy service. Ludmila Malova is joining us live on the line. Ludmila, a message here from Gazelle saying, I had my car serviced, had a small issue with the sunroof curtain. It was hanging on one side. I asked them if it could be fixed and they said no, it should be replaced. But then they pushed the button and it's now open, stuck. I am suffering in the heat. It costs 3,000 to 4,000 dirhams without the labour. I told them they should fix it for me, but they suggested only the labour charge for free. Am I entitled for the full price for free? Thank you. Tricky one. Ludmilla, what do you think?
I think it much depends on the circumstances and the potential evidence that she can rely on. It sounds like, based on the formation of the question, is that, in fact, there is a colorable argument for her to make that the car dealers actually broke her sunroof. Now, she would have to prove that, and perhaps there is a CCTV camera and maybe witnesses and so on and so forth, so that perhaps there is enough evidence for her to at least argue that, or substantiate her argument that they are the ones who broke the sunroof. Now, they could challenge that and say that, well, it was actually already broken. They just tried to help her and in the process sort of broke, I guess the roof got stuck. But really, I think she actually has a stronger argument because ultimately it was at their hand or after they touched the roof that it broke. So I think there's a very good argument for her to expect and demand that they fix her roof. But it is also understandable or predictable why they're only claiming that the labor, they would only cover labor and not the parts. Maybe I'd recommend perhaps there's a compromise that could be reached. Otherwise, what I would recommend for her to do is to file a request or complaint with the Consumer Protection Department. They are quite quite helpful, in particular with matters like this. Okay. And so let it be put the burden on the company to prove that they're not the ones who are at fault for causing this problem and why they would pay for the labor and not the parts. Can really sort of go 50-50, but I think she has a stronger argument than they.
Well, Ghazal has just messaged saying, I have evidence. So fingers crossed,
perfect.
Proceed. All right, brilliant. Another car question here from Farhad. And Farhad, I'm so sorry that your wife and daughter went through this, saying, my wife and 8-year-old had a small car accident. The other party used verbal abuse and shouted at my wife for more than 10 minutes. My daughter is traumatized and will not get into any car anymore. Can I file a case for emotional distress?
Well, yes, but the chances of actually receiving any financial compensation for emotional distress are fairly slim in the UAE, only because there isn't for now a reliable precedent to request and quantify in particular emotional distress. However, there is definitely a case for a criminal case, and that is for the insult and defamation sort of harassment and threat to the family. So there's definitely a criminal case that can be filed. And on the back of that criminal case, the listener can file a civil case and request compensation on the basis of basically a crime that has been that had taken place. Now, in terms of compensation, that becomes a trickier part because right now in the UAE, we don't really use, a compensation for future damages. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of time. But for now, in order to claim compensation, you need to present actual expenses or costs or damages that you can quantify. So if there are, for example, medical bills or some other kind of documentable evidence where you can show that you've suffered some kind of monetary damage as a result of your child being emotionally distressed, for example, psychiatrist or a psychologist, invoices and expenses, those ones would be reimbursable. But for in terms of the emotional distress, it's still a practice in the making.
Again, thank you for your message, Farhad. I'm so, so sorry that your daughter's not doing so well. Understandably, it does sound really, really traumatic for her. I've had a number of friends who've had quite bad car accidents in the last few months. And yes, there's whiplash and yes, there's damage to the car, but it is that getting back in the vehicle that can be really, really difficult. So absolutely, I think Ludmilla's point about having a chat with the doctor and seeing if there's anyone that she can talk to, whether that's play therapy or, just keep us posted though, won't you? We are taking your questions this afternoon on 4001. Ludmilla is with us. And as I said earlier, you don't need to put your name on a message if you prefer not to. We know when it comes to personal, private, financial, employment issues, privacy is absolutely crucial. No name on this one saying, if I have a will that's valid in my home country, do I still need a will drafted in the UAE considering the most recent changes to relevant laws? I'm not sure what changes this message you're referring to, Ludmilla, but perhaps you can shed some light on that as a general point.
Yes, there have been a number of changes to the personal status law, which in relevant terms may in the future make it more practical to just enforce a foreign will in the UAE. But for the time being, I would say, I mean, is it possible that when the time comes that these foreign wills will be enforceable just as domestic wills will be? Yes, I think it's likely that we're heading in that direction. But for the time being, I would say if you're a non-Muslim, I would recommend that you also have a domestic will that's registered in particular with the DIFC. And that's especially with regards to the real estate property, because right now there's a conflict in the law, which on the one hand allows foreign expats to apply the law of their country for the purposes of their inheritance. However, there's a different law that with regards to real estate property makes it subject to Sharia. So there's a conflict of laws, and this is why the DFC Wills and Probate Center was introduced, and it's just to cover that or to provide certainty with regard to the particular conflict of law. But if you don't have a DFC will, then you're still subject to the potential conflict, and therefore, it's, I'd say at this point in time, I would recommend it's better to have a domestic will. But certainly, you know, in fact, we have right now several cases where we're enforcing foreign wills directly from a foreign country, but they need to be adjudicated in that country, and then it becomes a matter of enforcement here. So it's possible we're heading in that direction, but it's not yet a proven practice.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Something of a quick fire round, so I want to get through four questions in 5 minutes, Ludmilla. Do you think you're up to the job?
Absolutely.
All right. A message here saying, bought some pretty expensive jewellery from a large retailer. It's since been valued at less than half of what I paid. Where do I stand?
Nowhere, really.
That's what I thought you were going to say. Sorry.
That's just buyer beware.
Buyer beware. Do your due diligence. Shop around. No name on this one saying, can a Muslim write a will in the UAE? Thank you.
In short, only if it's in compliant with Sharia, which in relevant parts, you can only, as a Muslim, you can only will 1/3 of your estate and only to a non-heir. And that particular will has to be registered and approved by the Dubai courts or the UAE courts. And no other wills, I mean, for the present, Muslims cannot register other kinds of wills in the UAE.
Okay, hope that helps. Mo asking, what are the firearm laws in the UAE? Is carrying a weapon legal or illegal? Can you get a permit for it? And if yes, how? Never had this question before. I'm kind of intrigued what the answer is, although slightly scared. Tell us more, Ludmilla.
The short answer is no. The firearms in the UAE are very strictly and highly regulated. There are, in short, three segments that can have the proper license, and obviously it's police, security, and armed forces. They are exempt. And then also certain kinds of businesses, like, for example, shooting ranges can obtain the firearm licenses, but they're highly obviously regulated. And then the third category, certain individuals can, but these individuals have to be UAE nationals and with the approvals from the Ministry of Interior.
Okay.
So if you're not a UAE national, you cannot do it. And by the way, this particular law also applies not just to firearms, but also parts and spare parts or anything that would ultimately comprise a firearm.
Thank you for that. There you go, Mo. No name on this one saying, need advice about a building company. Hired a guy and his team to redo our patio based on a Facebook page recommendation. He asked for money for materials up front. You can see where this is going. Three times he's cancelled now, and last week sent a message asking for a refund as it's been a month since I transferred the money. And I got an immediate response saying he would come. Well, guess what? He didn't. And he's not answering the phone. So have I lost my money? I don't have his address, only a phone number. Oh, anonymous. What would your advice be here?
If depending on the form of payment, so if the listener transferred funds through a bank transfer, for example, then there is a potential claim or option of trying to request a refund for that amount through what's called an order on petition. It's an expedited judicial tool, which he can do through the Dubai courts, for example, online system. And you request it's a court process, but it's an expedited court process where you just present, for example, a bank transfer and say that this is a proven commercial debt. If you have evidence towards a proven commercial debt, which, for example, a bank transfer would qualify, then you can file this what's called an order on petition. And on the back of that, the court issues a judgment within a day or two. And then once you receive a judgment, then you have to serve it to the other side within 15 days. And at that point, if it goes unchallenged, then the order becomes final, and then you can start enforcing the assets of this particular company or the individual. So I hope, and based on the listener's question, sounds like there was a bank transfer involved. And if you do have a bank transfer, then you have very good chances of being able to recover your funds through this order and petition.
Okay, I really hope that helps. Sarah's been in touch saying, is it allowed for a manager to yell at his employees, and what can we do against him? Oh, I'm intrigued by this one. And I'm sure lots of people are ears are pricking up going, yeah, I've had that boss. Is he or she breaking the law, Ludmilla? And if so, what are the processes or indeed evidence needed?
The short answer is yes, that would qualify as breaking the law if a manager yells at you, because it could be a violation of a number of laws. One, it could be an insult, deemed as an insult, or defamation, or harassment, or threat, depending on the nature of obviously the yelling and the words that are being used. But there is at least those four potential violations of laws. And in the UAE, these kinds of violations actually are criminal and penalized under the UAE Penal Code. And so the best thing to do is just if they are significant enough or egregious enough, is just to file a complaint with the police. And, and then I think that will be sufficient for the purposes of changing the manager's behavior in the office.
We're going to squeeze in one last question because you have been super, super quick. No name on this one, saying, what document do you need and where do you get it to designate someone to take temporary custody of your children if, God forbid, both parents should die until immediate family can fly in from their home country? Brilliant question, one we all need to be listening to.
Indeed, a brilliant question. So if you're non-Muslim, there is an option now. Right now, if you're a Muslim, there isn't. I mean, if you're Muslim, then it will be just subject to Sharia. If you're non-Muslim, you can register with the DIFC courts. So it's called a custody arrangement or custody or guardianship. It's part of the DIFC Wills Center. You can either do a full will, or you can just do a version of a will which only provides for the temporary custody and guardianship of your children. That's what I recommend. By the way, there are template custody arrangements for this particular matter through the DFC. So it's you can even do it yourself.
Brilliant. Ludmilla, thank you so, so much for your time today. Absolute whiz kid on all of the messages. You can find Ludmilla Yamalova at HPL Malvern Pluka. Have a wonderful afternoon and a happy international, no, it's UAE Father's Day to the man in your life.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
What makes a dad-friendly workplace? Paternity leave, apparently. McKinsey interviewed a group of new fathers and asked them about their experiences of taking paternity leave, and the responses were resoundingly positive. 90% said they'd notice an improvement in their relationship with their partner. A separate study reviewed by McKinsey found that 60% of men described time spent looking after their children as very meaningful. A fifth of them were concerned about what paternity leave might mean for career development, though. A point that might resonate with many women who have stepped away from their careers to raise children. We've been speaking to some dads here in the UAE, finding that they are desperate for the following: paternity leave and education allowance. Here's a message from Anwar saying, when my daughter was born 8 years ago, I had zero paternity leave and my application for annual leave was denied. Now I've got a company of my own. I give my staff the legally allowed 5 days of paid paternity leave plus another week, half pay, if they need to extend. I'm mum of two, Priyanka, and at the time her husband really needed that paternity leave, but didn't get it.
The first time when I was in labor, my husband was doing a handover in his office because he took a leave while he was not getting a paternity leave. He was in office when I was in labor and he was trying to wrap up and he was asked to give a handover before he could leave. Luckily, the second time around, it was an overnight labor. Thankfully, he was with me and then he told them that he's taking an emergency leave and he will be back in work maybe a week later. But it would have been so good if he got paternity leave. It would be less stress for him and he would have been able to spend some quality time with both the kids when they were born.
I'd really love to hear your experience on this. Can you tell us how many days that you were granted? If you want to give us an idea of when that was, that would be really useful as well. As Ludmilla Yarmolova noted an hour ago, it is 5 days paternity leave now here in the UAE. Let us know on 4001, the ARN play up, of course, there for you. And if you want to share your experiences, be it a company you're working for or have heard of that is going above and beyond, or how that lack of paternity really affected you and your family, we'd love to hear from you. Joining us is Dave McKenzie, recruitment professional. He's the group managing director for recruitment firm McKenzie Jones. David, you're back, and this time we're talking about paternity leave. As I said, legally 5 days paid here in the UAE. You run your own businesses. How long did you take?
It's a loaded question. None at all. But there again, I wasn't running my business when I had my kids, because as you know, my kids are a lot older, Helen. So I was at Monster.com in Europe at the time, and I was flying 5 days a week. But my boss grounded me for 10 days and said, you need to spend time with your family. And it was the best thing she ever did. So I'm a big believer that I think 5 days is too little. I think as a father, you need to bond with your child. And I think if you look at the US, they have 15 days, I think, for paternity leave. And I think in UK, it's 14 days. Mm-hmm. So I think, unfortunately, the UAE is slightly lagging behind the global norm.
It is interesting to look about elsewhere. In the UK, it's 2 weeks. Ed Miliband is calling for dads to get 12 weeks paternity leave. From next month, new dads in France will be entitled to twice as much time off. It's going to be set to 25 days, up from 11 previously, bringing it in more in line with Europe. And this can be split into two periods. So 4 days compulsory leave after the baby has been born, and then 21 days of leave, which can be taken any time within the first 6 months of baby's arrival. Japan offers at least 6 months fully paid leave for fathers. But back in 2017, only 1 in 20 dads took it. And a similar story in South Africa. Fathers account for just 1 in 6 of all people who take parental leave. It's been really, really interesting to see what happens internationally. And I'm curious in terms of what companies are offering here. As we said, 5 days paid here in the UAE. It was slightly less when our babies were born. And I was really lucky. We had pretty straightforward pregnancies and births. But you know, think about if you have a baby that needs to go into intensive care. Think about if you have a C-section, you're not able to hold and twist and lift that baby. You know, you do need that extra pair of hands. And more important than that, you need the dad around. I think it does dads a massive disservice to basically say, we don't value you at this time in your family's life. What are you seeing with companies when it comes to what they might deem to be benefits and perks, but others might deem to be just a basic human right?
I don't think many companies are pushing, unless it's a multinational, the paternity leave. And I think it's very much, we find individual cases where actually some dads don't feel they should take it because they're more worried about their jobs now. And I think you made a really good point, Helen. It's not about so much the baby, it's more about the mother and giving her some time out, and I think giving the father a bit of time to bond with the child. I think that's the most important thing we're missing here.
I completely agree. I really do feel for dads in those first few weeks, especially if the mum's breastfeeding, because the dad can just feel like a bit of a spare part. No one's checking in with him. And I think it does a huge amount to devalue the importance of that relationship between dad and baby. Lots of people getting in touch on this, saying 12 years ago, got 2 days off with a bank. Twitter, UAE, give 4 months. Twitter! Love it. Andrea saying 3 days for us. I had a C-section. It was horrendous to be left alone with a new baby and in so much pain. Peter got 5 working days, took another 5 vacation time. No name on this message. Says my husband got a week off and spent it doing DIY, getting a haircut, went to the osteo, got the car serviced. I was stuck at home, furious. 5 years later, I'm still furious.
Are they still together?
It doesn't say. It doesn't say. I think he might have missed the point of paternity leave, although I do admire the productivity. But I think you raise an interesting point there. You know, paternity leave could end up being a COVID-19 casualty. And according to the World Economic Forum report, many new fathers fearful of losing their jobs right now amongst the disruption caused by the pandemic and may opt to not take any leave at all. You know, how much pressure do you think dads are under trying to pay the bills and trying to keep their jobs, David?
Oh, immense. And I think that's massively underestimated, that, you know, we're still going through a recovery phase here at the moment. And I think people are still very worried about their jobs. And I think if you suddenly take some time off. I think people unconsciously worry about that. And I don't think you do, because having had two kids, I've got a very good relationship with my kids because I spent time with them when they were younger. And I think you never get that back. Nobody's ever going to thank you when you're on your deathbed, thanking you for working harder. But your kids will thank you for spending time with them, because they'll remember that time. Mm-hmm.
And you'll thank yourself as well. I think that's I think that's something a lot of new parents really wrestle with. We look at the emails mounting up, and we look at the work pressures, but you're absolutely right. You do not get that time back. Dave McKenzie, thank you so much for your time today. I think it's really interesting to hear from you, from both a dad and an insider when it comes to all things employment. So you would like to wave your magic wand and make that 5 days a little bit longer, would you?
I think it should be a mandatory 14 days with an extension of up to 28 days on half pay.
I'd vote for you. Dave McKenzie, thank you so, so much for your time.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We need to change the way we talk about paternity leave. It's not just time off work. It's not a vacation. It is a critical and yet all too short period of time for a father to bond with his newborn baby and in many cases help his partner recover from the trauma of childbirth. A new survey from Volvo Car USA and the Harris Poll found that 67% of men believe it is a badge of honour at their company to take the least amount of paternity leave possible. 62% acknowledging an unspoken rule in their workplace that men shouldn't take the full paternity leave. 59% reporting that no one at their company takes their full paternity leave. So how can companies help families and ultimately their bottom line by having a happy, productive workforce? We want to hear from you. Shout out to some of the great companies that are offering more. And if you want to share how having not so much affected you and your family, you're more than welcome to share your experiences on 4001. Oliver Wyman gives 8 weeks paternity leave, split as they wish. Thank you, Sheena. That's the American management consultancy. Message here saying, I work for Visa and men get a month paid paternity leave. Impressed. Joining us now, we've got Ibrahim Mogarella. He is the managing director of Great Place to Work in the Middle East. Ibrahim, a great place to work in the Middle East. I love the sound of this. You rank companies based on a number of criteria, and you have criteria specific to fathers. What are some of the things you look for when working with a company?
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you.
We are a great place to work. We are the global authority for workplace culture, and we want to understand who are indeed the best workplaces. When we look at fathers, there are a couple of criteria that we look at. We look at the physical, the psychological element and the emotional element. Do they feel this is my place to be? Do I feel encouraged to be here because I can balance my work life, like I can do the balance between the business life and the personal life? Am I able to spend time with my family? Is the management interested in me as a person? Am I just an employee? Or actually, do they look at me as a family man, as a father? Do they take that into consideration? What about if I need to take some time off? I have an emergency, I have something to take care of, I have something that I need to be attending. Do they take that into consideration? These are some of the elements and the criteria to take into consideration for us to be able to say this is a great place to work for fathers.
Ibrahim, multinationals, and we're hearing now Visa, Oliver Wyman, Twitter, have the reputation of offering better benefits and perks than locally grown companies. What are you seeing on the ground? Are we seeing, hopefully, a bit of a change or not yet?
Believe it or not, we are seeing a lot of local businesses who are now topping our best workplaces list from a country to a category to a regional perspective. Following COVID, the main element that employees and fathers in specific were focusing on is flexibility. As an example, being able to work from home for a couple of days throughout the week, or being able to achieve a healthy lifestyle as an example. It's not just about where you are, it's about when can I work? Because basically you have these traditional working hours. This is not going to be working out specifically after COVID. So you have to be really lenient about that. So this is why we're talking about the hybrid model that companies are actually following globally and locally, which actually is driving their culture versus the benefits and the perks that multinationals or local businesses have to adapt or have to offer.
Well, one thing I'd really like to see, and David alluded to it earlier about his boss insisting that, you know, he was grounded for 10 days after the birth of his children. I feel like it's so important that company leaders lead by example and take their full leave too, and we stop this, you know, this culture of, you know, beast mode at work and, you know, go, go, go and fetishizing busyness. Surely it's got to come from the top as well.
100%. Companies have to drive the culture from top and bottom in terms of understanding the human needs. It's not about the business objective anymore. It's about the humans behind that business. And this is what a great place to work is all about, to make sure that you have a great place to work for all without any exception. Everybody needs to feel innovative. Everybody needs to feel they are happy to be here. It's not, I'm forced to be here. This is not the great scenario, because sooner or later, this person will be at slight risk. They will be leaving you for another organization. You don't want that. You don't want to lose a talent. And you have a very tough war of talent at the moment because of everybody is hiring now, right? Because of COVID is over, everybody is back to full capacity. So everybody is now hiring. So you need to keep your great talent and looking at expanding that.
And now this is an opportunity to perhaps give some recognition. Are there any companies that you feel like are offering really good perks for dads? And what are they? Let's give some ideas to companies out there who could be going above and beyond and doing simply better.
100%. The companies who actually made it to the UAE, Middle East and Asia best workplaces have done some great initiatives when it comes to fathers. Moving from the paternity leave and the educational allowance, I mean, these are traditional stuff. What's more important, as I mentioned, is the listening element. You need to listen to them. You need to listen to their needs and understand it as well. Adapt your business strategy, not just on the business objective, but also on their human needs. What do they need? What do they require? How can I help them to perform better? How can I help them to become a high performer? As an example, as a father, I don't feel confident or comfortable putting my kids in the bus, right? I want to pick them up. So is the company being flexible about that? Can I go and pick up my kids from school? Or actually, as another example, I don't feel safe coming to the office. So I have children. Are you taking that into consideration as well? Do I feel safe to come to the office? Are you taking everything into consideration when you're thinking about that? Looking at it from another perspective, what are companies doing for the family, not just for the father? As an example, some of the best workplaces provided children with smart devices because they're learning from, like, they're having the learning from home, so they want to support them in the process. So they actually offered that. Some other companies actually, they included the families and children with the company's social initiatives by encouraging them to participate in the competition and games and reduce the COVID stress as well. We, as a great place to work, we're considering now, because of COVID and what happened, is to implement what we do globally by creating some category best workplaces. I think by 2022 onwards, we're going to be creating best workplaces for fathers, the best workplaces for well-being, and also perhaps best workplaces for parents.
Please keep us posted on that. I'd absolutely love to know more. Really interesting to get your insights. That's Ibrahim Mugabel, Managing Director of Great Place to Work in the Middle East.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Here in Dubai, we are very familiar with those tired tropes and stereotypes, the Jumeirah Janes, the Murder of Marys. Dubai is often seen, and I hope this is shifting, as a place where men work and women can either work or stay at home and look after the kids. And it is quite rare to speak to men who prefer to stay at home or circumstances driven to that decision and look after the kids while their wives work. One man has done exactly that during the pandemic. Does he think he's made the right decision? He's joining us on Microsoft Teams now to tell us more. It is Grant Lupson, a proud house husband. Grant, I think my husband would be supremely jealous of you, sir. You weren't always a house husband. You had a career in oil and gas for 20 years. Can you tell us about what led you to this new role?
Yes, good afternoon, Helen. Thank you.
Pleasure.
So I think 20 years was long enough, I felt. And obviously, when COVID hit last year, a lot of the big multinationals were looking to downsize. And I managed to secure a favorable exit from the company I was working for and worked for the full 20 years. We'd been traveling the world. We'd lived all over the world, settled in Dubai here 8 years ago. And really, it just felt like the right time. You know, I was blessed to marry my darling wife, Kunte. She managed to relaunch her career in 2016 after 2 years of maternity leave, extended maternity leave, if you like. And we felt that it was the right time to do it. I really enjoy being around the kids for the most part. And we managed to make it work. Yeah.
How old are the kids, Grant?
So I've got 10, 8 and 5, and I'll just give a quick shout out to Alex, who's 8 today and very proud.
Happy birthday, Alex! So it's all boys, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
You are in the trenches, my friend. Three boys, and presumably lots of after-school activities and running around. Are you a bit of a novelty factor as being being the man that drops them off, picks them up, and is perhaps a bit more present during those traditional office hours?
Yes and no. I think, you know, there aren't that many I know who've chosen to do it. Obviously, there's a lot of unfortunate people out there who didn't necessarily have the choice, but are hanging on in Dubai. And I think the key is just to make sure that you take the time to reflect on what your situation really is. And if you can make it work, if you can stay, I'd urge people to really have a look at that, because obviously we do have a good quality of life here. But at the same time, kids benefit from, you know, a hands-on parent who's around to maybe curate some good life experiences and maybe fill in some of the gaps that we maybe miss out here compared to being back home, wherever that may be.
Have you had any interesting reactions or even your own hang-ups about it at any point, Grant?
Yeah. No, good point. When I did first go through it, I really was sort of challenging myself on it. Am I making the right decision? But, you know, it's a good support network here of friends and family. And I was really pleasantly surprised by the support I've had from friends here in Dubai and also the family back home. Have said, look, you're doing the right thing. If it's right for you, it seems to be what makes you tick at the moment. Go ahead and do it. And I've not really had any adverse reactions.
I think, and I know you're out of the nappy years, obviously, with your boys being a bit older, but how well equipped do you think Dubai would be for a dad who might be taking on a baby and, you know, nappy changing facilities and all that, you know, mum's meetups? What would you reckon that would be like?
So that may be a bit more of a challenge, but I do know cases where, you know, perhaps people have taken early retirement. And one case in particular, I know a gentleman who took an early retirement with a 2-year-old, and he was okay with it. You know, you just get on with it. And as long as you can make it work, I do believe that the kids benefit.
Now, you've obviously gone from a 2-income household to a 1-income household, and I'm certainly not asking you to divulge your bank accounts, but has that been a challenge in terms of not just your self-identity when it comes to being a working man to now being at home, but also in terms of cash coming in? Have there been some adjustments there?
Good question. So we were blessed, I guess, to be a good while here, both earning, and we always sort of lived well within our means. So we're able to make it work. But at the same time, I think it's a bit of a misconception that as soon as you're a stay-at-home dad, that's it, you're done. You're not going to be contributing to the bank account. Mm-hmm. I've been in this situation for a year, and through friends and colleagues, managed to get involved in quite a lot of interesting startup opportunities. We've got a money management app for kids called Cashy, which will be launching very soon next month, which I'm a part of, and really excited to see that happen. And I never would have had the bandwidth, managing a career and trying to get time with the kids that I could, mm-hmm. if I hadn't made this decision.
And can I ask about your relationship with the boys then? What's changed, do you think, over the course of the last year?
Oh, well, you know, that's an interesting one, because it's overlaid, obviously, with all the homeschooling that we went through last year. And some of that has come and gone over the last months as well with various cases. So I find that I do know them a lot better. For the most part, it's been wonderful to see them develop through this. And kids have been amazingly resilient, I think, through all of the change that they've gone through at school and to their learning. But to be a part of helping them with that, helping them manage the inevitable stresses and strains has been amazing. It's I feel very fortunate that I've been around during this time.
I think it's wonderful to hear such a positive story. And I know, when I think about my dad, who loved work, and when he retired, it really messed with his head, because for so long he'd really equated his job and his self-worth. They, you know, they were intrinsically linked. And I think a lot of men perhaps would struggle with that sense of identity. I don't mean purpose, because I think obviously everyone has a purpose and everyone is absolutely valid in how they spend their time and what they're contributing. But to be able to get out of that headspace of, this is my job title, this is my business card, and you know, this is how I think the world perceives me. Has that been quite a complicated process to extricate yourself from that?
It is. And it's, again, it comes back to these hang-ups that you have. And I would say I certainly subscribe to that as well in the past. But an inescapable truth for me is that if we're all going to be living until we're 100 years old, which, you know, if you read books, that's supposedly going to be happening, right?
Yeah.
With the medical advances and all the healthy lifestyles we're getting into, I'm not sure I want to waste 10 to 15% of that when the kids are around and they actually want to talk to me because they're still quite young.
Yeah, the teen years are coming.
Exactly. It's just around the corner. So this, it really did strike me as the ideal time to take some time out. There's plenty of time and years ahead of me to go back to work if I need to, et cetera. But for the time being, I think, you know, the situation now with life expectancy and changing demographics means that we do need to maybe have a look at it and see if it works for us. I certainly know plenty of dads who can't do this, and they've said to me, look, you know, I'm in my prime professionally, I've got too much to get done, and there's no way I could do it. And I think that's fine too, because the kids ultimately will come to understand that, and we all need to be true to ourselves, mm-hmm. And what makes us tick. And I think that's an important lesson for the kids to get from their parents.
I think you're absolutely right, and unfortunately you are also right. We're probably working until we're 85 plus, so if the numbers stack up and, as you say, the relationship is right, I think this is a wonderful opportunity. I think it sounds like you're having a fantastic experience. So shout out to the boys. Happy birthday again, Alex. I'll let you get back to what is probably a busy afternoon, as you will always have. Grant, thank you so much for sharing your experiences. It's fantastic to hear your story and to hear it going so, so well.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Going to the text line 4001, Nandini saying, my husband has been staying at home for more than a year now. He lost his job, and while he hasn't found one yet, I think he's secretly enjoying doing school pickups and cooking for us. Not ideal, but I'm sure he's frustrated. But as long as we're all happy and healthy, that's what matters. We can live frugally until he finds a job. And coming back to education allowance, Neela saying, they mainly give education allowance to men, but if I could have it, I would happily ask if my husband stays at home.
Money matters with Zurich Life Insurance. Take optimistic action and shape your financial future with Zurich Life Insurance.
Fantastic to have you with us this afternoon, and we are here to answer your questions today. So please do reach out when it comes to life insurance, critical illness cover. We do have the experts joining us on the line. And I'm asking you, do you have a contingency fund? So many of us are just getting by given the situation. The pandemic has wiped out so many jobs, reduced salaries and benefits taken away. So many have been ill and have had to fork out huge amounts just to pay the bills. Businesswoman Risha Bagnari was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it almost took a toll on her finances. Risha, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm very good, thank you.
It's wonderful to hear you saying the words "very good." When was your last treatment?
So I actually finished my chemotherapy on the 14th of Feb, which was Valentine's Day, and then I finished my radiation on the 5th of May. So that was my last treatment on the 5th of May.
Congratulations. You're looking fantastic, and I'm really, really grateful for you to share your story this afternoon. I think it's a really, really important one because, you know, we hear the data about, you know, people who simply haven't put these things in place. But to actually get an understanding of the impact it can have on a life, on a family, on a livelihood is, it's really invaluable. And, you know, thinking back to your diagnosis, you couldn't believe that you had cancer, could you? Why was that?
Actually, nobody is prepared, with this thought of that they ever feel sick, because I was the fittest when I was diagnosed. I was in the best of health. I had lost a good amount of weight. I was exercising twice a day. I was on a healthy diet and eating the right food and, living a healthy lifestyle. So it actually came to me as a shock that, you know, I was actually diagnosed with breast cancer at that stage.
And then when it came to treatment, did your health insurance cover everything that you needed, Risha?
So health insurance covers most of the treatments, which are, like chemotherapy is covered, radiation is covered, but it doesn't cover a lot of other things like port insertion, which you need. It's a keyhole surgery, which has to be done before the chemotherapy starts. The plastic surgery, which is required, in case you decide to go for an implant, because you still want to feel like a woman and you want everything aligned and you want to keep looking good. As women, we are always conscious of the way we're looking and so on. So, it doesn't cover all that. So hence, it's very important to have some kind of a plan in place in order to make sure that what is not covered by health insurance, you're actually prepared for that expense as well.
And were you prepared then? Did you then have to dip into your savings or even your business finances to pay some of those bills? What happened?
Actually, I was very lucky. So I had actually started the Zurich insurance saving around 15 years back, and because the premium amount between the regular saving and the including critical illness was so small, I actually went for the including critical illness plan. I didn't have to touch my savings at all because Zurich was very 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 quick in responding. The moment I sent them the reports that I was diagnosed, they actually sent me the amount, just before I even started my chemotherapy. So it was such a relief, when you see an amount, your financial, you're worried about so many things which are happening around you. So one less thing to worry about is the finance, and that's what Zurich took care of.
I mean, I can't even begin to imagine, as you say, what you're going through, trying to make sense of a diagnosis, thinking about running your business, and then the bills, the amounts being flagged to you, thinking, how on earth is that going to actually be covered? And to realise that it was going to be must have, we talk a lot about the importance of, positive attitude, good mindset when you're undergoing treatment, and to have something taken off, off that, off your plate and off the weight of your mind must have been a real game changer. What does the future hold, do you think, Michelle? What's next? As I said, you're a businesswoman, you're in great health, last treatment back in May. How are you feeling good about the rest of 2021?
Oh, yes, I'm absolutely grateful. I'm full of gratitude that I've been given a second chance, a second life. And I'm very happy and I'm very positive about 2021 and what it has in store for all of us.
Well, keep us posted. Thank you so much for sharing your story. As I said, it's not just about the numbers, the data. It is about the people, and really do appreciate Rich's time today.
Money matters with Zurich Life Insurance. Take optimistic action and shape your financial future with Zurich Life Insurance.
Helen Farmer with you, and asking you to ask a pretty difficult question, and I hope you can answer it honestly. Would your family be able to manage financially if you weren't around to take care of them? You heard from Risha earlier, who said she didn't have a safety net except for her life insurance, and she wasn't sure if her situation qualified her to submit a claim. It has literally been life-changing and maybe even life-saving. And joining me live is Walter Diop. He's the CEO of Zurich Middle East. He's on hand to answer your questions, and many coming in. Walter, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really do appreciate it. And I think the sheer volume of questions we've had really speaks to the fact that many of us are quite guilty of burying our heads in the sand. We think of getting life insurance policies of being something that is a grown-up thing that we need to worry about. It's a problem for future Helen, not Helen in 2021. Can you explain a little bit about who needs life insurance? Can we go back to basics?
Yeah, good afternoon, Helen.
Hi, Walter.
Thank you for having me on. It's a great question. And I think as we heard Richard's story a few minutes ago, nobody expects things to go wrong. I think, insurance is one of those things that you don't really think about until you need it. Some insurance is compulsory. So you take car insurance. We take it for granted that we have to get our cars insured. We don't often think about insuring ourselves, our loved ones, and what would happen if something seriously wrong happens to us or to our families, and how would we cope? Mm-hmm. And at a very basic level, life insurance covers your life as it states. So should something happen to the individual who is covered, i.e. pass away, then a lump sum is paid to the beneficiaries of that. And whilst money can't ever replace our loved ones, what it can do is buy time and give the beneficiaries and the people that are left options to rework their lives, relocate themselves to a different country, start all over again, maybe change jobs, maybe dedicate yourself more to the family. Mm-hmm. It does all that. It gives you options. And that's why it's important, really. It's a responsibility that we all have, really, to look after our loved ones, the people really who are left behind. So we've got that type of insurance. Then there's also critical illness insurance, which is what Richard was talking about, which is, and this is a very common type of insurance, especially here in the UAE. And this is essentially an insurance that pays out on diagnosis of any one of 36 different illnesses. So anything from cancer to heart attack, stroke, to COVID-related.
You preempted my question. I was going to say, surely the last year must have had an impact on the insurance business. So COVID would be covered by critical illness, because we're hearing so much about long COVID as well and the really long-reaching effects of that.
Yeah, so I think at Zurich, all our policies pay for COVID. So we have paid our COVID claims, and to be honest, we're very lucky to be living in the UAE. The government has done a marvelous job of vaccinating us. The medical services have done a great job of looking after people that were ill, and so on a nationwide impact, the death rate of COVID was actually relatively low. It did have a major impact, obviously, on the people affected. It still does on society and all those things. But actually, mortality rates remain the same as far as Zurich is concerned.
Lots of questions coming in for you. I've got a really basic question that I hope you can help with. How on earth do you calculate how much, and let's start with life insurance, how much you would ultimately need and over what period of time? So looking at me as a 38-year-old and we've got property, how do I even begin to start putting a number on that?
So I think that's a great question, Helen. There's various ways you can do that. We've got calculators on our website, but there's many other insurance companies that also do the same thing, which give you a broad idea of the type of and the amount that you might need. But just think about, if you're in your 30s, you have a young family, they're going to need to live for another 20 years or so. So, you know, they're going to need to be, you know, they're going to need income for another 20 years or so whilst they get themselves through university or whatever it is and schooling and all of that, which will need to be paid for. So it gives you an idea of the multiples, you know, 10 times, 20 times your annual salary is not uncommon. Now, it's really important to get advice. I think you can do that by either going, like I said before, directly to an insurance company, going to a financial advisor, going to your bank, and they can actually have a look at your overall profile and come to a more specific number. But it's not going to be a year's salary if you think about it, because how long will that realistically last?
Well, with my kids, the amount they eat, not very long, let me tell you. But we have had a message here that I'm in my late 30s, a message saying, Walter, can a 67-year-old take out life insurance? Which I think is a great question. You know, is it too late to get cover at any point?
No, so we will cover people up into their 90s. So it's never too late. Now, it's important to understand that the older you get and the less well you get, the more expensive it becomes. But we look to cover everybody that applies to insurance with us, and in fact 99% of the cases that get submitted to us do get accepted. So we will always look to provide a solution. Sometimes there might be an exclusion or there might be a reduction in the amount of cover that you can get, but we will look to try and help.
Do you have any data around the average age of applicants for life insurance? You know, is it people who are being super proactive in their 20s or even 30s, or is it those who are slightly older and are starting to think about, you know, end of life planning or potential illnesses? Is there an average age of applicant?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think on average, the average for us is somebody 42 years old. So in their 40s. And that's because we have some young people who are very proactive and going out there and sorting themselves out. And then we also have some older people. We have a relatively young population in the UAE. Mm-hmm. So that does tend to put the average down slightly. But if we think about the claims, and this, Helen, is really important, really, because this is where the rubber hits the road. You know, the youngest claimant for life cover that we've had in the last 3 years is 28. The youngest one for critical illness is 29. And the average claimant for life insurance is 52. And the average for critical illness is 49 years old. Wow. And when you think about that, that is young.
It is.
If you get, like Richard, if you get, you know, diagnosed with cancer and you need to change the way you work or how long you can work for, or maybe you need to move countries or maybe adapt your home, This is where these type of policies come into their own and really can help out and give you the options that you need in order to continue to live a fulfilling life in well into the future.
And as Risha said, you know, amid a diagnosis or amid grief, the last thing you want to be worrying about is the finances. How are we going to pay for that adaptation? You know, uprooting children from a home that you want them to stay in. Lots of questions coming in for you, Walter. We're going to try and get through as many as we can between now and 5 o'clock. Ali said, I'm a single mother. If I got life insurance, who would the payout go to if my children were still under 18? Great question. Can you name, be it a sister, you know, a sibling or a parent, if you haven't got a partner?
That is called a beneficiary. And yes, you can. All life insurance policies allow you to nominate a beneficiary, and that the person to which the payment will be made. That can be a relative, a friend, somebody who would potentially be the guardian of the children. So that's one option. You can name somebody and the money goes to them, and they get given instructions by yourself as to what you want them to do with that money and how to spend it. Or you can actually, in some policies, put them in trust. A trust is a vehicle which is essentially you pass the ownership to the trust. The trust then has some rules, and that says, you know, this policy will, if the benefits have been paid out, it will be held in trust until the date that the children are 18, 21, 25, whichever date you choose. You give it some rules, and that's when the payment's made. So you have several options.
There you go, Ali. I hope that helps. Linda's saying it's too expensive. I can't afford it. What would you say in that respect when it comes to monthly payments? And I know obviously every case is going to be different depending on the payout, on the plan. But is there a way of making sure it is cost effective for something as crucial as this?
Yeah, so there's many different types of insurance. We provide solutions for life insurance for as little as 3 dirhams a day. So I do fully understand the listener when they say, well, you know, money's tight, that times have been difficult and all those things. I think, you know, when you reevaluate your the well-being of your family and really all your priorities, you need to decide whether the goals and aspirations that you have for your children and your loved ones, whether you feel strongly enough that you need those need to be met. Mm-hmm. I would argue that it's money well spent, because over the last 3 years, Helen, we have paid out in this country $136 million worth of benefits to customers living. Yeah, they wow. are neighbors, friends, people that we work with. We pay nearly $4 million a month, $3.8 million a month we're paying at the moment. And that number is increasing every year.
Money matters with Zurich Life Insurance. Take optimistic action and shape your financial future with Zurich Life Insurance.
Would your family be able to manage financially if you were not around to take care of them? It is a question that no one really wants to ask themselves, but it is so, so crucial, because amid the grief, amid the diagnosis, truly the last thing anyone wants is for their family to be worrying about the financial side. So we're taking your questions this afternoon, and joining me live is Walter Jupp. He is CEO of Zurich Middle East. Mr. Jupp is with us until 5 o'clock today, and I hope you've had your coffee, Walter, because you're a very popular man on the SMS. Jay has been in touch saying, my mortgage is already covered in the event of my death, but I'd like to get additional cover so my wife and son would receive a sum if I were to die. My question is, how long should I get cover for? I was thinking up until age 60. I'm 35 now, and my son and any other children we have would be adult and less in need of a payout, but would still inherit property. So coming back to our question, how do you calculate how long? Jay is saying up to 60. What would you recommend, Walter?
I think it depends on everybody's circumstances, Helen. 60, 65 is quite a normal age that people would take a top-up insurance. And it's important to understand you can take insurance for 5 years or you can take it for the whole of your life, right? So there are various options that you can. And each one of those options is different and it costs differently. So I think, but if you think about somebody's normal life, they in their 20s, they get their job, then they get a family, they get married, have kids, then the expenses go up. That needs to be covered for a period of time. So you can get insurance that covers you for that extra amount that you need for a set period of time. And then you can reduce it when you get older in life. Mm. And, you know, but you're then assured that your kids, your loved ones are looked after.
I think a lot of people didn't realise the flexibility in there, actually, which is is really valuable. No name on this one. It might become clear when I read out the message why she wishes to be anonymous. Message saying, my husband and I have a large age gap. I'm the younger one and have my own private life insurance, which pays out to my husband and three daughters. It's a large policy. Husband only has life insurance at work, so if he dies in employment, they pay out. Therefore, if he retires and then dies, I will get nothing. I need to be practical and sensible. He is the breadwinner. I would like to take out policy now, but as he's older, it could cost a lot. He is not keen, says I should use my savings to live. Am I being unreasonable? Should I pay for him to have a policy? What do you think? Can you take it out on behalf of someone else, or do you need to have their permission?
Yeah, you right. Everybody's case is individual, but you can take out life insurance on somebody else, depending on the circumstances. I think it's important that we get a lot of questions that say, look, I have enough savings, I have money, and that's brilliant. But what life insurance can do is actually protect those savings, because presumably you're saving that money to try and do something with it at some other point. And if do you really want to be using that to change your life, to relocate, to change your house, to do whatever it is you need to do to change your working patterns? So the answer is, yes, you can take the life insurance. She can do that. I would discuss it with your husband and maybe go and see a financial advisor to go through the pros and cons of each. Mm-hmm. Because whilst it might seem sensible to use your savings, depending on your circumstances, that it might be far more effective to essentially pay life insurance and protect yourself that way.
Hope that helps. Roa is asking, would a payout cover any debts? Which I think is actually front of mind for a lot of people right now, whether that's credit card or taking a loan, maybe looking to bridge a gap between reduced salary. Would that be beneficial? Could it go to the bank if need be?
Yeah, this is really common, Helen. Most people, when they take out a mortgage, the financial institution may well ask them to take out some life insurance to cover just in the event of something going horribly wrong. That debt gets paid off. So you can actually use and in that case, the policy is assigned to where the debt is. Yeah. So, for example, myself, something happens to me. I'm the breadwinner in our household. And I have a mortgage. When if something was to happen, the life insurance policy pays directly to the bank for the amount outstanding. So and then it gets resolved, and then you get your loved ones get to keep the house, and then they can do with it what they like.
Okay.
But you can use it really if you don't have it tied to a mortgage per se or a loan. You can use your life insurance in any way you want.
Getting a bit technical here, but anonymous message saying, I know this might sound like a stupid question, but I don't know a lot. If you're getting life insurance for your mortgage, do you have to get it so it starts on the day you buy the house? So nitty gritty, a lot of people are looking to buy right now. How aligned do those dates need to be, Walter?
Yeah, you do need to have it in place before you draw down the money. Otherwise, you're going to have taken the money and you're not covered for the insurance. So you want them to start at the same time. And a good financial advisor or your bank can help you with that to ensure that the date's aligned.
OK, brilliant. Can you talk us through, if you wouldn't mind, what you don't cover? You mentioned before in terms of claims that have been rejected. Is there anything in the fine print that we as consumers need to be mindful of?
So for life insurance, we cover death. Where we don't, so when I talk about the benefits paid, and this is really important, so we pay 98.1% of all the claims that come to us. And people might say, well, why is there 2.9% of claims or 1.9% of claims that aren't being paid? Well, we have had instances where, unfortunately, we've received death certificates from people that are very much alive. So fraud is a very big area that we have to protect everybody from. And the other one is non-disclosure. So sometimes people forget to tell or forget to put down things that have happened to them. So mm-hmm. It's no surprise that non-smokers pay a lesser rate than smokers. And sometimes we get individuals that say they don't smoke, and then if the cause of death is related to that, then that is non-disclosure. Mm-hmm. So I would urge everybody, when they're talking to their advisors or when they get taken out their insurance, to be honest, because we want to pay claims. That's what makes our industry work. And we want to pay everybody. And that is our ultimate goal.
I think that's, yes, exactly. Be honest, or it could come back to bite you on the behind, or indeed your family, years down the line. We did speak recently, and it's a really grim title of a show, but we talked about death admin. And this came about because my husband and I went away for a wedding and left our kids with my mum and dad. And I had what can only be described as a meltdown the night before, going, what if the plane goes down? What if we get hit by a black cab? And, you know, who will know what to do? And what it really was an incredible reminder of is having these things in place, not only having them in place, but actually telling people about them. My husband, as it happens, I think is worth quite a lot more dead than he is alive. So don't come pointing any fingers at me should something happen. Just stating the fact. But that's all well and good. But if I don't know where these policies are, where passwords are, what advice would you give to any couples who perhaps keep things very, very separate, Walter?
Helen, that is a great comment that you're making, because if you take anything out of our conversation today, take half an hour to talk to your partner or to your loved ones and to say, look, if something goes wrong, this is what we have, this is where it is, and this is what you need to do. So that doesn't cost anything. And actually, it can prevent an awful lot of heartache, because unbelievably, there are some cases where policies go unclaimed. And that's because beneficiaries or people are not aware that a certain solution was in place. Mm-hmm. So please do make sure that you do tell somebody. And if it's not your partner, then maybe a relative or maybe somebody of what you want and what you want done.
Couldn't agree more. We now have the death drawer. Who am I? I mean, that's not pretty great. Oh, people have death files, the envelope, they call it, and tell people where that is. People you trust, of course. Walter Jopp, thank you so much for your time today. I know you're an incredibly busy man of CEO of Zurich Middle East. It is zurich.ae if anyone wants to find out more about what we've been talking about this afternoon. As you said, there's calculators on the website so people can do a bit of groundwork, experts on hand as well to take that forward. Thank you so much again. Really, really appreciate your time and looking forward to speaking to you very, very soon.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.